Hello and welcome to From Fear to Fire, Secrets to Overcome Fear, Embrace Your Gifts, and Achieve Success. This is the place where real people share real challenges and where you can find a common bond and uncommon wisdom through their journeys to help you move from fear to fire. I am Heather Hansen O'Neill. I am your host today as always. And our first quote of the day today is by General Douglas MacArthur, a true leader has the confidence to stand alone, the courage to make tough decisions, and the compassion to listen to the needs of others. He does not set out to be a leader, but becomes one by the equality of his actions and the integrity of his intent. That's a good one, isn't it? So we have a fantastic guest for you today. Bill Merk has a lifetime of experiences that have shaped his view of the world, including 40 plus years of work experience, service in the U.S. Army, and being the VP of Business Affairs and Professional Organizations. Now he is an author writing about leadership tips and finding everyone's philosophy of life. Welcome, Bill. How are you today?
I'm great. Thank you for having me. I appreciate being here.
Oh, it's going to be fun. I can't wait to dive into some of these questions. So I was thinking about, you know, there are two of your books in particular that I would like to dive into. But before I do, is there anything about your military experience, your experience in business that I left out in that super short bio that you would like to make sure people know about before I dive into questions?
Well, I think you did a good job with that. So let's not belabor some of those.
We'll go into it. So let's begin with the leadership side. So you have a book called, So You Want to Be a Leader, Secrets of a Lifetime of Success. So let's start with some of the things that you learned as you were writing that book and all of the experiences that led to it. There are tips, there's background about values and all of that. But let's just start with an overview about how it came to be and why.
Well, when I finished working what I'll call normal work life, I was thinking back on a lot of the lessons that I'd learned during that time. And there's just so much. And I thought, I should write all of this down because there's a lot of things that I think others could benefit from. They may not listen to advice. A lot of people don't. But I want to put it out there anyway because I could help people avoid some of the landmines that are out there in a world of work by relating some of the experiences I've had and how I work through those experiences. Yeah. I will say this, I get bored easily. I really like to solve problems. Mm-hmm. And when you're in a leadership position, you're constantly faced with problems, some big, some small, but the big ones that get more complicated, those are the ones that are the true challenges. And there's such a great feeling when you get through it and realize that you are successful in what you went out to achieve.
That it's a shift of the mindset and the focus on when people are in the midst of those challenging times. It's a good way to look at it, is how you're going to feel on the other side of it. So you know what? I like beginning with a little bit of that heat. So some of those challenges today, I mean, there's so many that leaders face today, but there's a lot of, you know, you and I were talking before we got on here about taking the heat. Talk to me about that and fill our listeners in on what you mean by that.
Oh, well, when you're in a leadership position, a lot of the things that you are challenged to do have some fairly large consequences. Mm-hmm. Consequences that can be felt by people in the community, other employees, all those sorts of things. And it's not always something that people are happy about. And so as the leader, you're the one that should stand up before the groups of those people, explain what's going on, mm-hmm. and absorb their concerns and really listen to them to work through them. One of the things that I was involved in that was really like that was one of the universities I worked at. We were going to build a football stadium that was near some residential neighborhoods. The neighbors got really upset. They were worried about light and noise and people parking in their yards and all that sort of stuff. So I had about 20 different neighborhood meetings where I'd meet with the neighbors in the different groups, listen to their concerns, explain what we were doing. And a lot of times they were pretty hostile. They seriously were not happy with me. I was a messenger. But that's the thing that I knew is I was a messenger. It wasn't really directed. It seemed like it, but it wasn't directed at me as a person. It was directed to what I was representing. So I just felt like I need to take that heat from them, explain what we're trying to do. And it was really important that I listen carefully to their concerns, because I was able to go back to the planners, the architects, and say, this was a concern about lighting and sound and parking and all those kinds of things. And they modified the design and did different things to accommodate some of the things that I'd heard in those meetings. So I didn't just get absorbed with blocking everything out, trying to put on a little suit of Kevlar, but I listened to what they had to say, and they appreciated that. Yeah. The other thing that I learned too, that was kind of interesting, is just as one of the tips is, when you've got a hostile audience, often if you don't sit behind a desk or a table or something like that, if you stand up and get within about 6 feet of the group, they get a little bit nervous about that proximity, and the hostility fades a little bit. And so you can have a much more civilized conversation when you're standing there face to face with them just a few feet away, as opposed to having something that looks like a barrier between you and they.
You know, that's really fascinating, because it leads me to think about the fact that people today, with all of the virtual world, is that's that barrier that's put up, and there's so much negativity and anger that's expressed through that, because we don't have that connection that you're talking about. When you're close, when you're in person, when you can look somebody in the eye, it's a bit more challenging to keep up that throwing of the insults. It becomes more personable.
It does,
so
yes.
You know, while we're kind of talking about this, let's talk about one of the other issues that sometimes comes up. We were talking about what you call virtual vulnerabilities.
Yes.
Yeah, let's talk about that a little.
Okay. In today's world, we communicate increasingly, it seems, by text messaging and email. And what's lost in texts and emails is all of the body language that goes with communication. You can't see the other person's facial expressions, whether they're grimacing or smiling. You don't see the twitching of the shoulders or the movement. You don't hear the inflection in the voice. Are they loud? Are they soft? You miss so much of the communication. All you see is the words, and that leaves you interpreting those words in a way that you think they were meant, and you can easily be wrong. But when you're sending one of those messages, I think it's important to remember a few things. One is, those messages go out into the ether forever. You might be all upset today, and a year from now, you're in some legal deposition and somebody brings up an email or a text message you wrote a year ago. You might feel totally different today than you did when you, in the heat of the moment, wrote something, but you can't take it back. And it gets shown up on a big screen or in a newspaper or something, quoting something that you had said or done. So you just have to be really careful. I think text messages should only be used at work for things like, I'll be late to the meeting, or see you in 15, or let's go to lunch, something like that. And emails, they have a dual purpose. Sometimes you really want your thoughts to be memorialized. And an email sometimes is a way to do it. Not a lengthy one, not one of these 9 pagers, but enough to get your point across. And what I did, and it really helped me, was when I had one of those kind of emails to write that was had some seriousness to it, I would type out the first draft, and then I would bring in some of my trusted direct reports and say, read this and tell me how you're reacting to it. And if you were reading it, what would you get out of it? And often they would have really good suggestions, and I would edit and change a few sentences, take this word out or add a word. If when I was working in universities, the email had an impact on students, I had a student employee that would come in, different age frame from me, much younger, different culture, and I would have them read it and tell me how they reacted to it and if my message was getting across the way that I wanted it to be. So I was always very careful about emails and text.
I think that's brilliant. We don't take enough time to what you did. You went that extra step that I think is fantastic for people to do. But even just taking the time to pause ourselves and reread it before hitting send can be beneficial. I have a sneaking suspicion that we don't all do that.
the send, I say in the book, the send button is the most dangerous one on the board. And the second most dangerous function is the copy all.
Oh, goodness. I am in agreement there for sure. You know, we've been talking about, we dove into some of those difficult leadership moments, but let's shift over to some of the more positive ones. Like, let's talk about that integrity, that moral character, the principles, and how you feel about that and how it relates.
Yeah, I think you've probably asked people, how do they define success before? And I would define success as maintaining a positive sense of self-worth is success to me. And how do I do that? How does anyone do that? And I think part of it is you have some strong moral principles that you live by. You're honest, you're transparent. And when you're working with people, you try to come to decisions that are at least in your mind, are right. They're the right thing to do. Now, some of those right things to do aren't always popular, and some of them can get you fired. But if you follow your moral compass, if you go in that direction, over your life, you're going to come out comfortable with what happened, even though you aren't happy with maybe some parts of it. Overall, you're going to feel good about yourself. And when you look at yourself in the mirror, you're not going to really have regrets.
Excellent.
That makes sense, I hope.
Excellent advice. I firmly agree with you. When you come back to that, you know that you're moving in the right direction because you're staying true to you and who you want to be, not just who you are now, but who you want to be throughout. That consistency is super important. You know, before we move into more of the personal, the life that's related to your other book, let's just, I am the big fan of tips and suggestions for our listeners. So, you know, you've got some good ones as it relates to interviews or working with boards or keeping confidences. You've got a lot of great tips. Are there any that you would love to share with our listeners?
There's several. I'll just pick one or two. One of them is, I think we hear a lot in the working world about having a vision, sharing your vision. Well, that's a little bit more difficult to do than it sounds like sometimes, because what's the difference in a dream and a vision? A dream is something that you just say, oh, it'd be great if we were in the top 10 of whatever category. Well, what does that mean? That doesn't mean much to anybody. So you have to get a little more concrete with some specifics about your vision. What do you want to accomplish and why do you want to accomplish? And you need to answer the really big question to the listener. And that's always, what's in it for me? Mm-hmm. Am I going to be able to keep my job as we go forward with this scary new vision of yours? And so you got to make it less scary. And it gets into storytelling, using stories to help flesh out something to get people involved emotionally as well as reasonably. You want people to be excited about it, but it has to include them in your story. They are going to help make the vision become a reality.
Mm-hmm. I think that's incredibly important because people don't start caring about your vision until it means something to them.
That's
our human nature. That's just
it
who
is.
We
it
are.
Is. Yeah. It is. And another thing to remember too, when you're, say, using the storytelling as a technique to help you explain things, is I heard an expression once from a consultant I worked with years ago that really stuck with me. And that was, he said, emotion is the river upon which logic floats. Mm. And when you think about it, the river of emotion is huge. But the logic is a much smaller little thing floating on that emotion. And we're all humans with emotions. Now, emotions are good. Love, hate, fear, all of them are involved in survival. And they're important to listen to those kinds of things. But at the same time, you need to apply logic and reason to what you want to do. And over time, you'll start to develop a balance between your emotional reaction to things and your reason in reacting to things, and come up with the best solutions.
Mm-hmm. I love the visual. I'm a visual person, so I love the visual of that. You know, and the emotion. I'm also an emotional person, so I can see the river, I can feel the river, and that logic is floating right on top there. That's a good one. I like that a lot. So you mentioned that you had a couple tips. Was there one more before we moved into your breadcrumbs book?
When you get into a position of authority and a leadership position where you have a lot of resources at your fingertips, so to speak, there are people that are going to want some of what you have, whether mm-hmm. it's a raise or whether it's a budget allocation that's larger than what you were planning and all that. So they will play on your ego to get what they want. And you need to be just aware of that people will stroke your ego, make you feel really good in order to get what they want. Politicians are experts at it. In the business world, it's a little different, but it's the same principles involved. Mm-hmm. And greed is another thing that drives a lot of people. So greed and ego are a fairly dangerous combination. So it's not only protecting yourself from it, but being aware that you might do some of the same things. When you want something, you might start appealing to somebody's emotional side or some fear they have, or playing on their ego or their greed. Now, getting back to what I said before about a definition of success, you want to, at the end of the day, you really want to feel good about yourself. And if you participate in that to some extreme, you're not going to feel so good about what you might have done, whether it's on the receiving or the giving end of it. And so I just like for people to be conscious of those driving factors in a lot of things that happen, greed and ego.
You know, the word conscious, so important in leadership, but I think it's a great segue into the other area that we're going to be discussing today. So breadcrumbs, finding a philosophy of life, is a little bit more, well, you know what, why would I say it? Why don't you tell our listeners about the focus for that book?
Well, it started for me when I was in college. I was about 18 years old. I was sitting in a boring sociology class, about half asleep. And the professor was humdrumming about something. And then he looked at the class and asked, "What is your philosophy of life?" And that woke me up. And I thought, I'm 18 years old. I really haven't had enough experience in life to be able to say what my philosophy of life is. I'm not even sure what the word philosophy even means. And so, but that question stuck with me. So over the years, finally, when I've thought about it quite a bit. And so it was the genesis for this book, Breadcrumbs, to think about, well, what is my philosophy of life? Why do I see the world the way that I do? What are the lens that I look through? And how can I encourage other people to think about their own lives and how they see things, but to ask themselves, well, why do I see it this way? What experiences in my life led me to feel this way? And some of the more important things you can dig into, some of them can be uncomfortable, is you grow up with prejudices.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you have this prejudice? Some people never ask. They just live with it their whole life. And I think that's a shame. But if you think about why, then you have choices in life and you can choose to do something different. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where some of that introspection comes in. I think it's very helpful. And then when you become a leader, going back to the other book, mm-hmm. who you are makes a big difference in how you lead. But also, I think it helps you if you understand your motivations and the experiences you had, how they affect you. It'll help you understand other people a little bit and why they might see things the way they do. Mm-hmm. It's just a fascinating topic to me. So I delve into a lot of that in the Breadcrumbs book.
Well, you're definitely speaking my language. Any of our listeners here know that they're thinking, "Oh, Heather's getting excited now. She talks about this one." But that awareness, that consciousness, because we get to choose how we show up in the world and our beliefs. Sometimes we just go through life not even taking the time to do that. And I believe it's super important that you and I were talking about some of the additional layers of the onion that come into play with this guilt, for instance. Would you like to share a little bit about what we were discussing prior?
Sure. When you're a child, your very earliest years, your whole life is a small bubble. I'll use that to as a visual. You're conscious of the adults in your environment, the physical space you're in, and some of the other things about that small space. But the adults in your life, whoever it is that raised you, or like I said, unless you're raised by a pack of wolves, there's usually some adults in there. And you listen to what they say, and you don't have any experience. So whatever they say, you believe. As you start to get older and you start to get out into grade school, then high school, then maybe college or workplace or whatever it is you get into, you get exposed to more and more things. You have more and more experiences. So then you start to maybe question some of the things you were told as a small child. Well, you heard those things from people you revered. You thought they knew everything. And here you are having thoughts that are contrary to what they told you. And so that starts to bring on a sense of guilt. I feel guilty that I'm going against what they told me. But my experience and my reason tells me maybe the basics they told me were correct, but some of the details just don't make any sense. And so it's smart, I think, and wise to start to think through some of those details and to not feel so guilty about changing your views of how you see the world after you've had your own experiences that are different from theirs. That's what I mean by that guilt.
Yes,
It's not a bad thing in small doses. The big doses where it becomes debilitating, that's where it becomes a problem.
Oh my goodness. I completely agree with you, and I love that you're helping people to become aware of the journey that we go on, and that journey is important. It's necessary, even all of the elements that might be somewhat uncomfortable in
Those
that
are learning
journey.
experiences. They truly are. If you don't have those uncomfortable experiences, you've lost part of the process of growing as a human being.
You know, another area that you speak about in the Breadcrumbs book has to do with purpose and also specifically an obligation to society. And I suspect that that might tie back to my philosophy on humanity and doing good and putting good things out into the world, but I'm not sure. So could you share a little bit more about your thoughts on that and some of the things that you share in your book?
Sure, and I agree with what you just said. Humans are social creatures. Our whole survival is really based on our ability to work with other people and to get along with other people and to achieve things. I mean, if you really go back in time, I mean, we didn't have big sharp teeth, we weren't strong, we weren't fast. We were fairly vulnerable as humans, but we learned by working together. We could not only survive, but we could survive well. We could really do some great things. And so I'm going to digress just for a second. When I was in OCS, Officer Candidate School in the military, the first night before everything really started, we had a colonel that came in and said, gave us a little background and everything. And he said, look, one of the things I want you to know is that over this next 6 months, you will not be able to succeed to graduate if you try to do it alone. You're going to have to do it as a group together. You're going to have to help each other get through this program. And if you help each other, you'll be successful. If you do it as solo, you're not going to make it. And I think that's so typical of so many things. I'm not typical, but such a good lesson for a lot of things in life. We all need help. A lot of us won't admit it, but we do. And
I
being
think
a
that's
person.
a valuable lesson, one that it took me probably a little bit too long to learn.
It takes most of us a while to figure that one out. It does.
it's a good one. It's a goodie. So, before I have a question with a show called From Fear to Fire, that I'm going to get into a question about your journey as it relates to something that you had to overcome. Right? A lesson that you learned. Some people talk about a fear that they had. Some people talk about a challenge that they had, an obstacle that they had to overcome. So I will want to ask you that as well. So I'm giving you that as a little seed for you to think about. Now, before I do ask you officially that question, let's see if there are any specific tips. You know how I feel about having the listeners walk away with something actionable, specifically from the Breadcrumbs, Finding a Philosophy of Life book that you think would be a great tip or suggestion to give to the listeners.
I don't know that I would call it a tip necessarily, but what I really want people to do when they read the book is to think about their life experiences, starting in childhood, moving forward, and thinking about how those experiences influence the way they see the world. Like, why am I a Democrat rather than a Republican? Or why am I a Methodist and not a Baptist? Or why am I Muslim and not a Christian? There's all of those things that I think are worth, not necessarily to change any of it, to come to an understanding of, okay, this is why I am who I am. And if you start to really understand that, that helps you understand other people as well, I think, and just be more human.
I think that's brilliant. That's great advice. Thank you, Bill. Okay, now it's time to go back to that question I told you that I was going to ask you. Do you have that fear to fire moment, that challenge that you overcame and that you learned a lesson from?
Well, I've had a lot of little ones, and I've had a lot of medium-sized ones, and I've had a few big ones. I think I'll use this. I don't know if this is the best example in the world or not, but how much time do we have? This will take about 2 minutes.
We have the time. Go ahead.
Okay. Back in the 1980s, I was at a university, and we were going to build a field house. Well, we had a not we, but the National Football League went on strike, so Monday night football was not going to be held for a while. And so they were substituting college basketball games on Monday night, and they chose us in a game we had against Virginia Military Institute to be a Monday night game. Well, the arena that we were building wasn't ready, and the time frame was going to be really tight. And so as we got into it, and we're rocking along, and I got a call one day from the architect who said, I just got a call from the manufacturer of the seats for the arena, and they're not going to be ready for us by the time this needs to be open for the game. So, okay. So we arranged to, he and I, to fly up to Maine where Hussey Manufacturing, they made the seating. We went up there to meet with those folks. We get there, had the obligatory lobster dinner the night before, then showed up at the manufacturing plant the next morning, and they had a big sign out front welcoming us by name and like we were celebrities. And I said to the architect, we're in trouble. They're softening and stuff. Some really bad news. So we went in, and then sure enough, the owner said, we're not going to have those seats ready for us. So I went through the song and dance about why it was so important. He said, well, look, why don't you and the architect go back into the plant floor, talk to our supervisors and see if they have any ideas. Okay. So we went back and we talked to them, and make a longer story short, they figured out some substitutes, some things they could do with other jobs and all that. And they figured out if we could take them piecemeal rather than one shipment, they thought they could make it. So great, high fives. So we go back, and then we get closer to the time for it to be open. We're down to a few weeks, and the contractor comes to me and says, we got what we need, but we can't, our workforce, we just can't get it done. There's too much for us to do. So I had a supervisor that worked with me on a maintenance crew that used to fly damaged helicopters out of Vietnam under fire. He was pretty interesting guy. He was almost quivering from excitement. He turned to me and says, "Look, how about if my guys work at night while they work during the day, we can get this done." The contractor was in such deep trouble there, even with the liabilities and everything, he agreed. So we started that process. The first couple of nights didn't go so well. Our guys were messing up more than they were completing. Tempers were flaring. But after a couple of three days, they started going faster than the regular crew. And so there's a competition that started. And so it looked like we were going to make it. And then on a Saturday morning early, the Monday night game's coming up. Saturday morning early, they were almost done. And I get a call that said, "We're running out of a special type of bolt that we cannot buy here. We need 700 pounds of them, and we need them by Sunday." This is Saturday morning,
oh,
and we're in
my
Virginia,
goodness.
And the plant is in Maine. So we called around. We found a private pilot who had not been drinking, picnicking on a beautiful Saturday. And we got him in the air in his plane going to Maine. And he calls me and he said, on the radio, he says, "Well, I got 20 more minutes before I lose contact. So give me the final instructions of what to do when I get there, because I'm in the air." I said, "Great." And so I called the airport, the local FBO, and I said, explained it. It said, "Our pilot's going to be there at 11 o'clock tonight to pick up some bolts and fly them back." And there's a little silence, and the FBO guy says, "We close at 10.
Oh my gosh.
And that's what I said. And I said, "Well, what would it take to get you to stay open another hour?" He said, "I don't know. I'll have to check with my supervisor and call you back." And he hangs up. So I'm in a construction trailer sitting there, 20 minutes starting to tick. The whole job is on the line here. And he calls me back before the 20 minutes was up and said, "I talked to my supervisor. We can keep it open that extra hour, but it's going to cost you." And I said, "How much is it going to cost?" Not really caring, but said, "How much is it going to cost?" He said, "It's going to cost you $15 for my time." I said, "Oh, okay, we can handle that." And so we got the bolts. They came in Sunday morning. I had some people go pick them up at the airport. We got the bolts in there. And right after that, the contractor cut through the main electrical lines leading up the facility, and everything went dark. So we had to get on the phone and get the local utility company to get everything fixed and all that. We finally got it all done Monday. About 3 hours before game time, 3 hours before game time, we got everything done, the safety inspections done, the whole thing, and the game came off. So that was I really learned a lot about Murphy's Law.
And how to persevere, it sounds like. And
oh,
to
yeah,
be
absolutely. And
creative.
Be creative and adapting to the new circumstances. It was all of the lessons rolled into one big ball there. That we had to
also,
figure out.
You
And
know,
I'll
the
tell you, the feeling
teamwork.
of satisfaction at the end. Oh, the teamwork. Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. We had a
And the
lot of
satisfaction. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, because that's an important one. Celebrate the satisfaction that you felt. Go ahead.
Oh, no, that was one that I think was a lesson in just about, if it can go wrong, it will. But, and I'll use your word there, teamwork, getting the right people involved, not giving up. Thinking creatively, you can make really great things happen.
Oh, that's wonderful. So this 30 minutes flew by, Bill, as I knew it would. So how can people reach you, find out more about your books? What would you like to share with them about that?
I think the easiest way is I have a website, is William F. Merck, all lowercase, all run together, .com.
Okay.
WilliamFMerck.com. And it's got information about those two books. It's got information about magazine articles I've written, some other things. So that's the simplest way.
That's wonderful. And we'll make sure to put a link directly to that site into the show notes for you and anyone listening who is not near a pen at the moment and can't write it down. We'll make sure it's nice and easy for you folks. So it's time for your final parting words of wisdom, Bill. What do you have for us?
Always keep honing your skills. Always try to stay current with what's going on in the world around you. Knowing that everything changes, just keep up with everything and really think about your place in it. And going back to protecting your positive sense of self-worth, do things that you know are right when you go through this world, and you'll be okay.
I think so. I think that's valid life advice. Thank you, Bill. I appreciate you,
Sure.
your time, your wisdom. And listeners, if you love the show, please share it with a friend or 40 and leave us a review. We love those as well. Thank you so much. And everyone, we'll see you next week.